Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Dr. Walt Brown is my favorite scientist. He wrote the book In the Beginning, a best-selling creation book about evolution and the global flood. Dr. Walt Brown authored The Hydroplate Theory, and that's what this show is going to discuss. He got a PhD from MIT. He's taught science courses at the U.S. Air Force Academy and elsewhere. Well, Dr. Walt Brown, welcome back to Bob Enyart Live.
Nice to be with you, Bob.
Could we describe the hydroplate theory? I'd like to take a crack at it, and you could help me out.
Good luck.
Okay.
It's about 250 pages, by the way.
That's right.
So you're biting off a big hunk, but let's give it a try.
Okay. As God originally created the earth was covered with water, and then God said that he created the firmament, which was the crust of the earth, and he separated the water from below the crust from the seas, the water above the crust. And so there was one original continent on the surface of the earth, Pangaea, scientists, geologists have called it, and Noah's flood happened, the global worldwide flood happened when the crust of the earth broke open, and as the Bible says, before it mentions any rain, it says the fountains of the great deep broke open, and then it also rained, and that's what destroyed mankind and all the land animals on earth, except for those saved, Noah and his family, and the animals they brought with them on the ark.
Right.
So the hydroplate theory is that there was basically a subterranean sea under the crust of the earth.
Under the entire crust.
The entire crust.
Yes.
So it was like a slice of a sphere.
That's right. As a first approximation, like a spherical shell, roughly maybe 3/4 of a mile thick. It contained about half the water that's on our Earth's surface today. There would have been pillars or places where that the Earth's crust would have touched the bottom of the subterranean water chamber. But as a first approximation, think of it as a spherical shell.
Okay.
And it was down about 10 miles is my best estimate.
About 10 miles beneath the surface of the Earth.
Right.
And so we say there was only one landmass, Pangaea, and that's where today we'd find Asia, Africa, North and South America. So let me start by asking you this. I was taught, even in grammar school back east in New Jersey, that you could take the continents and squeeze them together where the Atlantic Ocean is, and they fit like a jigsaw puzzle. But what I didn't realize, I was just a kid, and they told me that, and I believed it. But what I didn't realize is they appear to fit, but the proportion is way off.
That's right. There are a number of problems with that fit that is in probably every encyclopedia and every textbook on the earth sciences. First of all, they've removed some of the material, some of the continents. They removed Central America. They removed southern Mexico. They removed the Caribbean. They don't say where they went. Another thing is they have made a cut below Europe and above Africa and rotated the two to help make the fit better. Another thing they've done is they have shrunk the area of Africa by 35%.
They shrunk the area of Africa by a third. That's a big shrinkage.
Right, and they get away with it.
Now, the reason they get away with it, I think, is because when you look at a globe, it looks really plausible because it's a beautiful jigsaw fit. So there's something behind the idea, except that they got it wrong. They didn't understand how it happened.
Yeah, they had to distort too many things, get rid of too many things, rotate too many continents, and make slices where there shouldn't have been any. No evidence for it.
So the way that it happened, as I understand it, through reading your book In the Beginning and also comparing it with the Bible, and then looking at the maps of the oceans, the ocean floors that you provide in your book and elsewhere, is that there is a mid-Atlantic ridge, a crack, basically, in the center of the Atlantic that not only is in the Atlantic, but if you follow it, it goes all around the globe.
Yeah, it follows a great circle path. It's like the seam of a baseball.
Hmm.
It goes all around the Earth. The whole thing is called the Mid-Oceanic Ridge. It's 46,000 miles long. It's the longest mountain range on the Earth. Most people, Bob, don't even know it's there.
Don't even know it's there. And so if we start out with just talking about the portion, the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, That's basically the area where the crust of the earth cracked. So
it cracked along the whole mid-oceanic ridge.
Right, it cracked everywhere. It started somewhere.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, I don't know if you would agree, it seems that it started on the Atlantic side of the earth.
That's what most people think, but there's a complicated reason why I feel it started up between where today we have Alaska and Siberia.
Okay. All right. Well, that's interesting, and perhaps we'll get into that, but let's continue here. So when the crust of the earth cracked, the water from under the earth began to shoot up under tremendous pressure.
That's right.
And it began to erode the landmass, the crust, above the crack.
That's right.
So the Atlantic Ocean was never there. It was one continent, Pangaea, and along that crack, then all that 10 miles thick of landmass began to erode as that water shot up with great force. And that's what formed the Atlantic Ocean. And with all that chunk of the continent being removed, that made that part of the crust lighter. So the floor of the Atlantic literally lifted up.
That's right.
Where the Pacific got sucked in.
That's right.
The Pacific got deeper, the Atlantic got...
As the chamber floor... Subterranean water chamber floor rises to become the Atlantic floor, something has got to give way underneath. There's not going to be a cave opened up underneath the Atlantic floor. The pressures are too great. There's going to be material moving from the direction of the Pacific toward the Atlantic. You got to think of the Earth in three dimensions, not just a map, but three dimensions. And so as the Atlantic floor rises, and it will rise fast, Bob, the first couple of inches it rises is going to make it rise even faster. It's an instability.
Right.
And so as the chamber floor rises to become the Atlantic floor, it's pulling down the Pacific floor.
Which helps us to understand why the Pacific has these incredibly deep trenches like the Mariana Trench and others.
And so many volcanoes. There are roughly 40,000 volcanoes on the floor of the Pacific, especially the western Pacific.
Is it considered like a ring of volcanic action?
The Ring of Fire surrounds that area. But the center of this highly volcanic area in the western Pacific is exactly within a half a degree of latitude and longitude, exactly opposite the center of the Atlantic floor.
Opposite the center of the Atlantic floor.
Yes.
So when the fountains of the Great Deep break open and that mid-oceanic ridge, basically where the crust cracked and the waters come up, and they erode away the Atlantic Ocean. So that crack has a shape to it, and the erosion sort of follows the shape of the crack, and that's why it looks like you could squeeze the continents together.
That's right.
Because it's the way it eroded.
And
not because the continents separated over a billion years.
Right. If you take a very good globe that shows the details of the ocean floor, you'll find the continents... North America, South America, Europe and Africa and Asia, the continents fit together, not against each other very well, but they fit against the base of the mid-Atlantic ridge.
Mm.
That's where the fit is 10 times better.
Yeah, that's exciting. And also, you said get a good globe, but your book in the beginning and your website, creationscience.com, is a fabulous resource, partly because you provide the maps and the graphics and the photos step by step through the process for people to understand this.
Right.
Now, as that water is coming up with such enormous force that it's literally eroding away all the landmass where the Atlantic Ocean now is, that part of the crust is gone.
Yeah, there's another element here. The subterranean water chamber, I'm estimating, is about 10 miles down. So when the crack forms around the Earth, and it's forming because the pressure is building up in that subterranean chamber.
Mm.
We won't get into why it's building up, but
yeah,
it's explained in the book. The pressure is building up, so you get a crack, and once the crack starts, it's going to rip because the whole crust is in tension. And so now the crack is there. We have walls basically of a sheer vertical cliff 10 miles high. You will never find on Earth today a cliff that's 10 miles high. The highest a cliff can be on the Earth today is 5 miles. What's the difference? Well, if you ever had a cliff that's 6 or 7 or 8, 9, 10 miles high, the rock at the base of the cliff
would
is under such compression,
crushed,
such pressure, because of the overlying rock that it would crush.
Mm-hmm.
And so the walls of that 10-mile-high crack are crushing continuously as the water is coming out.
I see.
And so that water, as it's being expelled upwards, and it's going with a indescribable velocity and pressure. And it's not just due to the pressure of the weight of the overlying rock. And that's something maybe we better not get into.
Okay.
But it is cleaning out all that rubble that is forming because of this crushed rock at the base of the 10-mile-thick crust.
So as that water is shooting out, then some of the water and some of the rock and debris is basically being thrust up with such tremendous force and velocity that it's able to escape the Earth's gravity.
That's right. And let me just kind of whet people's appetite here. That water, we call it water. And you might think, well, water can be in three forms. It can be a liquid. That's what most people think about. It could be a solid like ice, or it could be a vapor like steam. But there's another type of water, and it's called supercritical water. Supercritical water has been known about for over 100 years. But it was just in the last 5 or 6 years that scientists performed the kinds of tests that show us really what's going on in supercritical water. I won't get into it here. But you will see, if you go to the book and read it, and it's free on the Internet, you can just read it there.
Yeah.
You will see why the energy was stupendous and why that water came out with such extreme velocity.
Well, we could imagine just they make electricity by boiling water and turning turbines.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine, aside from that issue, 10 miles thick of continent pressing down on a subterranean chamber of water. The forces are just...
If you're just talking about liquid water, and you're talking about the pressure of 10 miles of rock resting on it, that would only expel the water upwards at a half a mile per second.
That sounds pretty fast right there, though.
That's right.
To an amateur like me.
That's not enough to escape the Earth's gravity. You've got to be going about 7 miles per second to escape the Earth's gravity.
All right.
And do other things. But when you understand the supercritical water idea and how much energy is down there that's going to be expanding that water, that supercritical water, and cooling it almost instantaneously as it's coming up, the water would be going many miles per second.
Okay, so now for many years, in fact, probably 30 years of my life, I would look up at the moon and be so amazed, but also frustrated.
You saw a man there, didn't you?
Yeah, the man's face in the moon. But I would ask myself, and I'd ask others, why does the moon look like it's had the tar beat out of it? And let me ask you this question. Which side of the moon, the near side to the Earth or the far side, which side has been hit harder, has been hit more? Do you know the answer to that?
Yes, the near side.
The near side. Now, it seemed to me that the far side, if in fact the moon had been hit over millions or billions of years by random meteorites, that the far side would be hit way more because the Earth should be like a shield to protect the near side.
Right. Or to be not too contentious with the evolution, say they should be hit about the same. But the point is, the moon keeps one face always toward the Earth. It's locked. Mm-hmm. The moon rotates once every complete orbit, about every 28 days. So the far side of the moon was never seen by modern humans until the space program.
Right.
They took pictures of the far side, and they say, whoops, something is quite different on this far side. It looks as if the near side of the moon has been peppered with buckshot. Buckshot that would have been fired from the Earth. And that buckshot, I say, was fired by the fountains of the great deep.
In other words, when the crust of the Earth cracked open, as the Bible describes the fountains of the great deep breaking forth, then that water shot up, and you're talking about supercritical water producing enough energy to literally launch the water and debris into outer space, and that's what beat up the moon the way we see it today.
That's right. That's right.
Wow. And so how about the comets and the asteroids that are in our solar system that seem to sometimes mar the otherwise perfection of the solar system? For example, NASA has recently collided a piece of a spaceship with a comet just recently, and they've just released their findings.
Yeah, that was the Deep Impact mission. The impact took place on the 4th of July, about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Temple 1 was the name of the comet. The spacecraft came, a couple hundred miles from it and fired an 820-pound bullet into that comet.
Mm-hmm.
And cameras were focused on it from the spacecraft. The debris that was kicked up was photographed and can be analyzed in a very sophisticated and very detailed means. There were about 70 telescopes on Earth that were focused on the thing, including the Hubble.
I know that NASA, along with evolutionary scientists and astrophysicists and all, they believe that comets were formed in the outer reaches of the solar system. And, of course, your hydroplate theory explains that comets, which are pretty much dirty snowballs falling through space, that comets were formed from the Earth, that that's where they came from.
Yeah, the fountains of the Great Deep launched them. Comets have been known for, let's say, 30 or 40 years to be nothing but, as you say, dirty snowballs, water being one of the biggest constituents of comets. Where do we find water, Bob?
Well, we find a lot of it on Earth.
The Earth is the only place that I know of in the universe that has liquid water on its surface.
Mm.
The Earth is sometimes called the water planet.
Yeah, two-thirds.
So if you want to know where comets came from, and you know that comets contain an awful lot of water, I would start by saying, is there some way the Earth could have launched comets?
Right, exactly. After all, they tell us that you find a meteorite in Antarctica, and they say it came from Mars.
Yes.
And
they say it was splashed off of Mars. Something hit Mars, an asteroid, a comet, or a meteorite hit Mars and splashed this debris off that came and hit the Earth. Well, to escape Mars, you've got to be going about 3 miles per second.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine an impact on Mars that would kick up stuff going that fast and get through even the thin atmosphere of Mars. Try picking up a hand of dust, Bob, and throwing it up in the air and see how high it goes.
Okay, right. And so still, you find water in the solar system, and the Earth is filled with water, and the atheist scientist will laugh at the idea, they'll scoff at the notion that that water came from the Earth when we're two-thirds covered in water.
That's right. And another thing, talking about Mars, talking about liquid water, about 3 weeks ago, NASA had a big announcement. It's one that they've been thinking about for 2 years because they cannot figure out how it could possibly be true. Liquid water has been detected not only on Mars, but detected flowing in the last 2 to 5 years. They've taken photographs of Mars 7, 8 years ago.
And they seem to see
a difference.
They've taken
photographs of the same place just recently,
right,
and they can see the flowing indications of liquid water. Here's the problem. Mars is too cold. Mars is much colder than Antarctica is in the winter. So how do you get liquid water there? Well, they say maybe it came up from inside Mars.
Right.
That's nonsense. Any water trickling up from the inside is going to freeze.
Right.
It's going to freeze several miles below the surface. It's going to be ice. It's not going to gush out on Mars. And the channels that they've found since the Viking program in the 1970s, which took the first pictures of Mars, close-up pictures, found that these channels mark the flowing of a voluminous amount of water, as if a dam broke. And the volume flow rate of that water, they estimate, exceeds the volume flow rate of all the rivers combined on the Earth that enter oceans. So water trickling up through the crust of Mars is not going to form the equivalent of the Amazon and the Mississippi and the Indus and the Congo combined.
So what do you think is going on?
Well, the fountains of the Great Deep launched with such incredible velocity that the water and the debris in that water, much of it, escaped the Earth's gravity.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen? Well, let's go back to Apollo 13, one of the early moon exploration spacecraft. Apollo 13 made a discovery. The astronauts on it discovered something. They tried throwing waste material overboard. And to their surprise, that material, which they thought would be long gone, disappeared forever almost, kept orbiting the spacecraft.
So in other words, they sort of flushed their toilets outside the craft,
right?
And they ended up with this waste.
It kept orbiting. Well, why was that? Well, it was pretty easy to understand once they thought about it. When you're standing next to the spacecraft sitting on its launch pad, you don't feel its gravity because its gravity is minor compared to the gravity of the Earth that you feel very vividly. But if you're far from Earth and near the spacecraft, the spacecraft's gravity is the only game in town.
Right.
And so the spacecraft's gravity can hold an object in orbit about it, and those objects become moons of the spacecraft.
Right.
So that's what happens. So when the fountains of the Great Deep are launching water, water vapor, most of that water, roughly half of it, flashes into steam when it gets into outer space, is launching all these rocks. Remember I talked about the rubble at the base of these 10-mile-high cliffs? Those big rocks are going to gravitationally attract smaller rocks and water vapor and frozen water, ice.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to orbit. And because of all the vapor, the gas orbiting as well, those solid particles are going to decay and come closer and closer and closer and finally touch the big rocks.
Mm-hmm.
It's called a sphere of influence, people in the astronautics business and space dynamics. This has been understood for a couple hundred years, by the way. A French mathematician figured all this out. So there's a sphere of influence every object in space has. And so these large rocks are going to attract material, and as that material gets attracted, they become even more attractive of other material, and they're going to grow into be comets or asteroids.
Mm.
The asteroids especially are going to be propelled by a phenomenon dealing with solar energy. You've seen these little windmill things in glass bulbs that you shine sunlight on them and they start to spin.
Right.
They're composed of vanes, black on one side and white on the other. I'm looking across my office here. I've got a demonstration of that in the window right now. That's called a radiometer. That effect is acting on these comets and these asteroids, especially the asteroids, and it's causing them to be pushed out, just the way sunlight pushes those vanes, the dark side of the vanes, pushes them out. It's going to push those asteroids out, and they're going to be spiraling outward away from the Earth. And what's the next planet out from the Earth?
Mars.
So it's going to be spiraling over the years or centuries, and if any of them collide with Mars, all that frozen water, that ice, is going to immediately turn to liquid and to steam.
Because of the energy of the collision.
That's right.
All right.
It's going to be like a dam breaking.
So I can understand how we could look at Mars and see evidence of those collisions.
Right.
In that water, which then would it freeze or dissipate?
It would do both. Mars has very little atmospheric pressure. The impact is going to add a lot of heat to it. It's going to melt, and a lot of it will go poof into vapor. But the vapor is not going to leave Mars. It's going to form moisture in the atmosphere. It's going to eventually rain out or end up at Mars' poles where it will just lock up.
Okay, well then, how about the photographs showing apparently recent flow?
Right, right. That recent water, well, first of all, let's go back to the water that was landing in the centuries after the flood. Where's that water going to go? Well, a lot of it's going to soak into the soil. Those impacts are going to produce craters. And those craters show all sorts of signs of having been filled with liquid water.
Hmm.
So that water is soaking into the craters and the crater walls. So there's ice under the soil of Mars. It's locked in the spaces in between the grains of sediment. Now, if a meteorite, and most meteorites are very, very small, strikes one of those crater walls, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to add a lot of heat.
Hmm.
It's going to melt that ice that's frozen in the crater walls, and that liquid water is going to drain down the crater wall. And that's exactly what they've been showing photographs of.
Wow, that's fascinating. Let me ask you this. When NASA, their Deep Impact, they looked at what this comet was made of, and I've read in their own reports, they were startled that they're finding minerals from the inner solar system when they believed that comets were formed way out in the outer solar system.
That's right.
That seemed to be support for your hydroplate theory that comets were launched from the Earth.
Right. To be more precise, to be more accurate, they should have said, it looks like it's got all the minerals and chemicals that are on the Earth. And some of those minerals only form in the presence of liquid water. But as you know, Bob, liquid water should not be found in outer space.
That's right. And so, in fact, the Earth has, what, thousands of minerals on it?
About 4,000 known minerals in the crust of the Earth. You know?
And I've read in your book, olivine.
Olivine is one of the most common, yes.
And did they find olivine in comets?
Absolutely, and I had predicted it beforehand. I've put it in writing beforehand. You've seen it in the book that was published years before.
I sure have, and I've made that argument. In fact, when NASA was getting ready to slam into this comet, I called some scientist friends and told them what they would find. And thanks to you, Walt Brown, my prediction to them was true. It was really your prediction.
And the chief scientist of one of those space programs got a hold of the chapter before it was published in 2001. He saw the prediction.
All right.
And he was making just the opposite prediction.
That's right.
His name is Don Brownlee.
We are out of time right now, but Dr. Brown, I'd like to continue this tomorrow's show. Can we talk about the Grand Canyon?
Sure can.
All right. Thank you so much. The book is In the Beginning by Dr. Walt Brown. It's available to read at his website for free online at creationscience.com. And we've been selling it here for years. You can get a beautiful hardcover copy of this book. In fact, they're signed by Dr. Walt Brown. If you order them from us this week, you can call us at 800-8-NYARDS. That's 1-800-836-9278. Or you could order them from our website at kgov.com. In Colorado, consider Maranatha Christian Center. What a beautiful school in Arvada. Maranatha, may God bless you all. It's January and a new year. We can help you make some great New Year's resolutions. I'd like to grow more this year in my knowledge of Scripture. I'd like to be more well prepared to talk to others about eternity. I'd like to become more mature as a believer. Would it please you to achieve these goals this year? If so, please consider letting us help you. At Bob and Yurt Live, we've assembled really great teaching resources for you to grow in your Bible knowledge and to grow as a Christian and to develop personally. I'd like to recommend a subscription to one of our monthly resources. If you subscribe during this month of January, as a gift, right away, we'll send you an extra month's fulfillment. If you subscribe to our monthly Bible study albums, we'll send you two albums for the first month to get you on your way. If you subscribe to our monthly sermons, we'll send you 2 months' worth of sermons. If you subscribe to our monthly videos, we'll send you an extra DVD. Either call us or subscribe online. You can call us at 800-8-NYARDS. That's 800-836-9278. 836-9278. Or go online to kgov.com. That's kgov.com. Just click on the store and then subscriptions. You can be more prepared to influence others for good, including your own family, coworkers, and friends. If you let us help you achieve these goals, you will also be helping us to stay on the air and to continue to reach more people. So again, to subscribe to our study albums, sermons, or BEL videos, please go to our store at kgov.com or call us at 800-836-9278.